Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this evening's public lecture. It's barely necessary for me in the LSE community to introduce Julian, who, of course, has been here for much longer than me. I think he was with Beveridge, weren't you, here 60 or 70 years ago?
If only.
And is, of course, the Richard Titmuss Professor of Social Policy at the school and has written extensively on aspects of public policy. Most recently, his book Motivation, Agency and Public Policy of Knights and Knaves, Prawns and Queens, Pawns and Queens, was very widely and very well reviewed. Now, in fact, very shortly after I came to the school, Julian asked if he could come up to my office to see me. I was, of course, hugely honoured that one of the pantheon members of the LSE should want to meet the humble new director. So, of course, I immediately agreed, and as he came in, I abased myself and kissed his hand. That's the way professors like to be treated here. And then he sat down and asked me a question. And I have to say, I mean, I have been around a bit in my career, and I like to think that I'm not easily shocked, but on this occasion I was, because Julian said that he was thinking of going and working full-time for Tony Blair in No. 10 Downing Street. Well, I did what I think any caring employer would do. I offered him counselling. We have here an organisation called Inform, which assists people who are captured by sects tries to offer them a means of escape. But there was no talking him out of it, I'm afraid. But I did extract two important conditions. One was that he should set a firm date for his return, which he did and which he stuck to. And secondly, that after coming back at some suitable point, he would deliver a public lecture on what he did on his holidays. And that is the long-standing background to this. And Julian meets his, shall we call them pledges, I guess, would be the right word to use in this context. So this evening, he's going to talk to us on the Blair legacy. That's not a piece of news. The Prime Minister has not resigned this afternoon, to my knowledge. The co-Prime Ministers are still in place. But Julian's going to talk to us about competition and choice in public service.
The trouble with speaking after Howard is that it almost inevitably is a sense of anticlimax. Yes, I am going to talk about competition and choice in public services. I think the central idea is really quite a simple one. It is that the competition and choice that the government, the ideas of competition and choice that the government is introducing, are going to reform the health and education services and going to make the health and education services more efficient, more responsible, and I believe, and this is a key element, more equitable, more socially just. And as such, they're not only desirable, but I think actually they're essential if the welfare state is going to survive. Now, choice and competition in the context of public services is not easy to sell, it has to be said. The ideas are fairly controversial and make for great caricatures. There are two that I quite like, if this works, which it's not doing. There we go. That's the first one I quite like, and the second one. It was actually very difficult to get hold of any pro-choice cartoons. I must thank my researcher, Ruth Robertson, who's done an excellent job on helping me with quite a lot of this material. I am going to try and sell you these ideas tonight. And I'm going to try and convince you that they're not some sort of mad-eyed policy wonk sitting in No. 10 in need of counselling or the victim of some weird religious sect, but that actually there is an analysis underlying it, quite a profound analysis underlying it, that the ideas do have a kind of intellectual coherence that will that do amount to a serious proposal, and as I dare say, probably the only proposal successfully to save the welfare state. When Tony Blair's government came in 1997, it found a public services that in some respects, not in all, but in some respects were creaking at the seams. The NHS, for instance, there were very long waiting lists. The waiting lists, 185,000 patients, still waiting for 9 months in 1998, a year after the government came in, there were still 185,000 waiting, 67,000 waiting for more than a year. It was inefficient and wasteful. I mean, as late as 2002, have a look at this slide. Interesting thing about this is that this, basically what this shows is the number of available and unoccupied NHS beds within 60 minutes travel time. And if the area is mostly blue, then that suggests there are between 200 and 3,000 available and unoccupied beds within an hour's travel time of the population. And it's only the red where there are less than 100. And you can see that the areas which are badly served are sort of North Cornwall, North Devon, bits of Cumbria, and bits of Lincolnshire. So on the whole, the population is reasonably well served, but these were not being used. And this is at a time when there were massive waiting lists. Still, we were still running at around about 2002. This, incidentally, is a map from produced by some of my colleagues, my ex-colleagues at the University of Bristol, Carol Popper and Simon Burgess. It seemed to be inefficient, it seemed to be wasteful, it was unresponsive to patients' needs and wants. It seemed often to be organised in the interests of the producers or the providers rather than the interests of patients. And the people, if anyone was dissatisfied, the only place they could go was through private insurance, and then it was only the better off. And there were also more subtle problems. When I was at number 10, I was struck by the number of people who would who'd come through there with some sort of brilliant, innovative idea for reforming healthcare. It could be a clinical reform, or it could be an organisational reform. They were coming to me really as a last resort, saying that they tried to get these ideas adopted within the NHS. They tried to even get pilot projects to get someone to try them, and nobody would, let alone roll them out across the NHS. I wasn't much use either because I didn't know where to send these people or how to actually encourage innovation. Basically, the incentives were not there for within the NHS to adopt new ideas. Even more problematic, there was the problem of the founding principle of the NHS that was not achieving equity. And if I can just put up a few of the results here, this is results from some research done here by myself and colleagues and Department of Health. I actually did this quite a lot when I was actually at number 10. With unemployed and individuals with low incomes using services less, intervention rates for certain specific treatments following heart attack, hip replacements 20% lower among the lower socioeconomic groups despite 30% need. Even GPs, a one-point move down a seven-point deprivation scale, GPs were spending less time per consultation. So we had a range of problems within the NHS. I have to say one cannot blame them necessarily on previous governments. As I've indicated, some of these were still going on by 2002. In education, things were a little better. There had been some improvements that were in trend, but it was still true that by 1997, a third of children left primary school without basics in maths and English. A third of pupils in London and Birmingham got five or more, did not get five or more good GCSEs. Less than a half of primary schools were judged by Ofsted as having good or excellent teaching. So there were a whole set of problems that the public services confronted. It was not a golden age. There were not sort of perfect services around. There were problems, services with severe problems that needed addressing. Now, of course, part of the problem was money. The Oneness Report, commissioned by the Treasury, estimated that the cumulative underspend of the NHS over the many, many years it had been in action, and measuring underspend by the amount of money that it had not spent compared with our European neighbours, was of the order of £267 billion. That's about five times as much we spend on the NHS now. But money really wasn't the only problem. I mean, if you think about the various things I listed earlier, the various problems that we encountered with the NHS, there was the waiting list problem, there was inefficiency, there was unresponsiveness, slow to innovation, inequity. Not many of them are directly connected with money. In fact, probably only the waiting list problem you could perhaps really relate back to money, and even that, you could say, was at least partly due to the inefficient use of capacity that I put forward. So if they weren't to do with money, what were they to do with? Well, I contend that the principal problem arose from the monopoly nature of provision. In the unreformed NHS and the unreformed education service, going back for 20, 30 years, parents had little choice, patients had little choice, and if you were unhappy, you basically had to stick with your local service. This was bad in and of itself. I mean, this seems to be disempowering of patients and parents and so on, is bad in and of itself. But it's also bad for almost the more fundamental reason that it gave little incentive for providers to improve. Chaining people to their local school or their local hospital is not really an effective way of getting hold of making good local services. Monopolies have never been of any kind really the way to achieve strong services, let alone public services. So some kind of reform was probably essential, was definitely essential. And the sort of first set of tools that the government turned to were essentially top-down performance management. Now, you can deal with monopoly by telling people what to do. You basically pick them up by the scruff of their neck and you say, right, you will provide a good service. You will meet these targets. If you don't meet these targets, you will lose your job. If you do meet the targets, you might get a reward. And I must say, I mean, I'm an economist by training, and we're sort of brought up to be deeply sceptical of this kind of command, what's known as command and control way of doing things. I have to say, having been in government for a shortish time, I've become less convinced of this. I suddenly can see some advantages in command and control. It's a bit funny, that. And indeed, to some extent, it has to be said, the targets worked. I should have mentioned this in terms of money, I'm sorry. The money is increasing in both health and education, going up in each case is about 50% in real terms to 2004-05, and going up even more next time. But this, and here I must pay tribute to my colleague Gwyn Bevan, the LSE, who's done a lot of work on the ability of the system to meet targets. This shows the ability to meet the target having patients spending less than 4 hours in major accident and emergency departments. The aim was to achieve 98%, and indeed, as you can see, it is a target that was achieved. And that's despite a 24% increase in accident and emergency admissions. Percentage of patients waiting for hospital admissions greater than 12 months. As you can see, again, the target was to reduce that to zero, and indeed it was achieved by 2003. Now, what's interesting here, though, is to compare this with the performance in other... This is England. To compare this with the performance of other parts of the United Kingdom. Now, Wales and Scotland deliberately and consciously decided to avoid the reforms that the English were introducing. They avoided choice and performance management. They avoided performance management. They eschewed choice and competition. Indeed, they made speeches saying this was not the Welsh way or this was not the Scottish way to do things. Well, what was the result? Dramatic increases in waiting lists in some cases in England and Wales. In Wales and Scotland. Northern Ireland wasn't much better. And now this was despite the fact that Wales and Scotland not only started off with more resources per head than England, but also the rate of growth was similar. So they, throughout this period, they were getting more resources per head than England. And yet, it's another indication of the fact that just money on its own is not sufficient to actually make the difference. Of course, Wales then adopted some of the English reforms, including performance management and some element of choice. A second offer system was introduced. And you can see it's had some quite remarkable effects. And Northern Ireland, similar. Scotland, incidentally, stopped measuring things in this way. so we don't know what's happened in Scotland, but I'm told that they are going to resume at some point. We'll take it from there. In education, too, there were improvements. The numeracy and literacy improved sharply over this period. And that was probably due to, at least in part, due to a straightforward command and control device, which was the numeracy and literacy hour that people were just told to do place, and it worked. Now, it sounds from that as though, well, maybe targets are the way to go. But although, as I say, I'm slightly more impressed than I used to be at the importance of targets, I still believe at a kind of fundamental level that they are not the long-term solution to public service reform. They just have too many problems associated with them. A ceaseless bombardment from the top of instructions demoralises and demotivates providers, especially if you're talking to professionals, doctors, teachers, who are used to a great deal of autonomy and trust and react very badly to being consistently being told what to do. They distort priorities. It's easy, the common phrase is you hit the target, but you miss the point, that whatever is actually aimed for may be hit, but that there may be much more important aspects of care or education that are not met. It encourages gaming, fiddling, maybe straightforward fiddling of the figures, or maybe more subtle changes of behaviour that mean you meet the target, but not in the long-term interests of the service. For instance, some evidence that in order to meet that 98% accident and emergency target, that there's some suspicion that some places actually admitted patients into hospital, into the general ward, into the medical wards of hospital, in order to show that they'd done something, even though the patients did not need it in that time. I don't think in the long run targets, top-down performance management is the way to go. What we need, what you actually need, is something that's more of a bottom-up system, a bottom-up system that empowers the users of public services. I'm sorry to use jargon like empowers, but it's accurate. The users of public services empowers the patients and the parents and actually embeds within it the kind of incentives that are necessary for the service to improve in and of itself without having continuous bombardments and talk from the top. There are essentially two ways of doing that. One of them, and I'm sorry, here comes another jargon term, but one of them is what they call voice. Now, voice is one way in which users can be empowered. Users can express their dissatisfaction or their unhappiness directly to the provider. So the parent goes and talks to the teacher, the patient goes and talks to the GP or to the hospital. If they're not getting satisfaction that way, they might be more formal avenues of voice, like complaints procedures or whatever. You might even also talk to parent governors at a school. You might stand for being a parent governor yourself. So there are all kinds of mechanisms of that kind which go under the sort of general rubric of voice. And you could go down the route of strengthening voice in order to achieve these kind of ends. And indeed, I think there's some place for that. I think there's some place for that, as well as I think there's some place for performance management. But at the end of the day, I don't think you're going to achieve it that way either. And there are a number of reasons for that. I mean, one is that choice voice is rather cumbersome. If anyone's ever tried to engage in, say, NHS complaints procedure, I was once at the other end. I was on a hospital board, and I was the complaints convener. And I must say, when you saw the hurdles over which complainants had to jump if they had the mildest problem with the service, hard hurdles, I may say, that I put in place and helped sustain being on the other side, so to speak. It was appalling. But I think the real problem, there are two other problems with voice. One is that at the end of the day, on its own, it doesn't give much incentive for improvements. I mean, if a provider doesn't wish to listen to the voice, there's not much that the person can do, particularly if they cannot exit, if they have got no choice, if they can't go anywhere else. On its own, voice doesn't give, on its own without choice, voice doesn't have very much power. In fact, one of the nice things about choice, I think, is that it gives power to voice. And the second problem concerning voice is that it fundamentally favours the better of. If you look at going back to the various things that I listed earlier about the NHS, if you think about all these, they're all cases, really, where the better off are successfully persuading the professional, in this case the GP or the doctor, to provide them with a better service. The middle classes are just simply more confident, they're more articulate, they're better informed, they're just better placed to use the instruments of voice to achieve their ends. So the problem with voice is not only that I think on the whole it tends to be ineffective unless it's accompanied by choice, but also at a fundamental level it tends to favour the better off. Another example taken from education. Who wants to be a school governor? Is it the working class? Is it the poor? Is it the disadvantaged who want to be governors? No, it's the middle class who want to be governors. And it's very interesting that the main reasons not wanting to be a governor with time and lack of confidence in both groups. But it clearly affects manual workers much more than non-manual workers. So there's a fundamental problem. There are fundamental problems with voice, which leaves us with the question, well, what to do? Well, it won't surprise you entirely that what to do seems to me to involve choice and competition. And what you're really going to need for that, well, it's going to need three elements of choice and competition for it to work. The first is the choice itself, that users have to have choice. Parents have to have choice of school. Patients have to have choice of hospital or choice of facilities to offer services. But choice on its own is not sufficient. There has to be some penalty for those that are not chosen, and some reward for those that are chosen, because otherwise the incentives aren't there, the incentives to improve aren't there. So the money has to follow the choice. The most obvious incentive structure is money. The money has to follow the choice so that the people who are chosen, the providers, the schools, the hospitals that are chosen, are rewarded, and those that are not lose resources and are penalised. So an essential element for this is that the money follows the choice, and that's coming out in the National Health Service with the so-called payment by results system. It happens under the school system with the funding formulae and so on. Third condition is that we must have new providers. There's quite a lot of evidence from other areas of the economy that really the way in which you actually generate competition is not really by just setting these things at work among a whole series of old type providers, but you need to do some sort of transformation, or you bring in new types of provider. And that, again, is what's going on. The foundation trusts in health, independent sector treatment centres, independent sector diagnostic centres, new kinds of providers coming in healthcare, and in schools, in education, the academies, and now the trust schools. In some cases, transformation of old providers, giving them a lot more freedom, a lot more route to go on. But again, that's an essential element. If we're really going to get the competition, if we're going to get the incentives that we want, that has to happen. Now, I would imagine that already you're totting up the problems in your head with this. I mean, of course, there are many difficulties associated. There are problems about the quality, about the information, that people will need information in order to be able to make choices. There are problems about what do you do about failure? What do you do about these services that fail, the hospitals that fail, the schools that fail? What do you do about capacity planning, if we still believe in planning? There are a whole range of difficulties. I do have answers and some suggestions to deal with that, and maybe we will have a little time for questions, I think, Howard. So maybe they will be able to deal with some of those. But I actually want to concentrate on three, I suppose, more fundamental criticisms of the whole choice agenda that have been put up. The first one, and this is a standard one, if you're working in choice, in the choice world, is you hear that people don't want choice. They want a good local service. The second one is it'll be the better off that get the good choices. The poor will be left with poor hospitals, with sink schools, and so on. And the third one is a more sort of subtle one in some ways, that there's something about the public service ethos that is undermined by choice and competition, particularly competition from the private sector. And sometimes this is encapsulated in the phrase, which I don't fully understand, but I sort of know what it's getting at, choice threatens the public realm. So let me just go through these and just sort of... people don't want choice. They want a good local service. And here's a classic quote of that, to that effect, from the Fabian Society producing. This is usually a criticism that comes from the left on this. How many parents would prefer to send the child to local school with no choice in the matter, though the education offer was national standard, high quality? Well, let's unpack this a little. The first point is that people do want choice. It is simply wrong to say people don't want choice. This is a case from a survey undertaken by The Economist, showing on the left-hand side, showing how important it is you to have more choice, which hospital treats you and your family, and which state school children your family attend. And you can see very sizable majorities in both cases. So it's interesting, actually, the second one is also quite interesting, because it gives you some idea as to why people want choice. And it's something to do with giving themselves more control over what's going on. You'll notice that the need to allow patients more control has greater priority than giving the NHS more money. The British Social Attitude Survey has just produced its 22nd report, and again it says the same kind of thing, much in, I may say, to the surprise of the authors of the report, who on previous occasions have actually come out against choice. And they've, with again substantial majorities of patients who want choice. But the interesting thing about this is not so much these aggregate figures, although I think they are interesting, but what happens when you break them down into men and women, into the poor versus the better off, the educated versus the uneducated. And the kind of presumption that underlies an awful lot of the criticism to the left is that it's the middle classes that want choice, probably men that want choice. Generally the better off who want choice. In fact, there's actually a quote, I think, from Roy Hattersley, I'm not sure if I've got it here, that says the choice is a fetish of the middle classes. But actually, if you look at gender, it's women who want more choice than men. Both men and women want choice, the majority want choice, but it's women who want it. It's the lower social classes, the semi-routine and manual workers who want choice more than the managerial and professionals. It's the those on higher on lower incomes who want choice, earning less than £10,000, want more choice than those earning more than £50,000. Those with no educational qualifications want choice more than the better off. This isn't just a freak of health, but the Audit Commission did a survey of local government services and again concluded that the groups that most in favour of choice were the least privileged, those from the North and Midlands, up to slightly, I'm not quite sure where that comes from, but those from the North and Midlands and women were the ones who mostly wanted choice. Nor, I may say, is this a product purely of Britain. If you look at other countries too, that if you look at the US, for example, that there again a general majority in favour of choice, school choice in this case, but with the minorities being in greater support than the rest for school choice, and the black parents were much more enthusiastic about choice than the better off. In a way, too, if you think about it, it is precisely those groups that people feel are not going to be most disadvantaged by choice, or the people who really don't want choice, are precisely those groups that this kind of survey evidence suggests do want choice. And it's not altogether surprising. And this is something close to this is the Roy Hattersley quote, the choice obsession of the suburban middle classes. But actually, it's not, and we've just seen that it's not. And if you think about it, the reason is quite clear. It's because the middle class are actually very effective at manipulating the non-choice systems, the systems that we've discussed this already. They're effective at mobilising voice, and with their articulacy, with their confidence. And with, crucially, of course, which I haven't mentioned so far, crucially, of course, their ability to move house and to move house, to buy up properties near the good schools and so on, they can manipulate the system quite effectively. They don't need the extra power that choice would give them. Whereas the poor who cannot use these, facilities, who feel disempowered by the system, do want choice because it gives them power to do so. What about the second objection, which was that it's the rich that get the good, whatever the poor might want, they aren't the ones who get the good schools. It'll be the better off who gets the good schools under choice, and it'll be the poor who get the bad schools and the bad hospitals. And this is the argument here that the disadvantaged and the dispossessed will always do better. Now, there seem to be sort of three things going on here. There's the three bits of this proposition. One is that the poor don't want choice and wouldn't exploit it if they were offered it. Well, we've seen that seems to be incorrect, that they do want choice. We'll come to the actual exploitation of choice in a moment. The second is that if they do want choice and they do exploit the offer, they won't be very good at it. They won't actually be able to make choices in a sensible way, unlike the middle class, who are very effective at making these choices. And the third point is that even if they are good at making choices, even if they do make the choices and they're good at it, they will get disadvantaged by the selection system. But what will happen is that the schools and hospitals, the good schools and the good hospitals, will attract long queues, and the schools and hospitals will begin to choose people from those queues, and they will choose the better off because they're easier and cheaper to deal with or improve. So this is the phenomenon known as cream skimming. So instead of actually having parents and patients choose, you have schools and hospitals doing the choosing, and that will disadvantage the poor. Now, let me just go through those three points. Now, the first one we've discussed about whether they will whether they want choice, whether they... Or I've given you a lot of survey evidence about whether they want choice or not. This is an example of whether people actually use choice. It comes from some choice experiments that were done in London in healthcare, and it looks at the take-up of choice by a variety of different groups. And you'll see that there's very little difference, including not much difference between those with basic educational status, higher educational status, below average income, above average income. The only real significant difference is the employed versus the not employed, and that's understandable, I think, about the way that the choice was taken up. So, on the whole, the poor, there doesn't seem to be any reason to suppose the poor will not take up choice if they're offered it. It should be said, and this relates to the second point about making effective choices, they were helped a great, everybody was helped a great deal in making these choices. They were given transport costs, and also they were given patient care advisors. These were people who actually helped people. They were often sometimes trained nurses, professionals who helped the people make the choices. And I think actually, and that's, there are useful lessons to be learned from that. These were very popular with patients instead of these patient care advisors, very useful. And they provided a lot of other functions than simply helping with choice. The government has sort of recognised this and has picked it up in the proposal that in the school's white paper, that there should be choice advisors that will help people make the decisions, and probably that those school advisors will be concentrated on the poorer areas. I mean, you don't really need to have choice advisors across the whole range of the income distribution. The idea is you can concentrate on the poor. So there's something to all of that. What about the cream skimming argument? It has to be said that this is the thing that John Prescott got pilloried for by saying that a good school, that the danger of having a good school is everyone will want to send their children there. There was a cartoon I was trying to find, I could never quite find it. If anyone knows where it is, let me know. It's a child talking to its parents and saying, I hope you're not going to sacrifice me on the altar of principle and send me to a good school. But, I mean, in a sense, but he did have a point, and we know what he means. I mean, there is an element of truth in this, that there is a problem. And I think it is something that the advocates of choice have to address, is the problem of cream skimming, the problem that providers end up doing the choosing. But it's not impossible to deal with. In fact, there are some quite readily available solutions for dealing with the problem of cream skimming. For example, you cannot allow providers any discretion in making choices. They have to choose whoever they get, so to speak. And that happens in the NHS under the new system of choose and book and the electronic booking system. It's basically the GP and the patient together who make the choices, and the hospital has no discretion over whom they accept. The compromises that are now going through in the education bill seem to me to be classic examples of how the choices are gradually being taken away from the schools and being given to being allocated closer to the local education authority. I'm actually not really in favour of that. I think those are quite difficult routes to follow. I prefer leaving schools with discretion on admissions, but what I would prefer to see would be an incentive system that actually gives them an incentive to take children from poorer areas or whatever. For example, the children, and we said the money follows the choice, is an essential element of choice procedure. Well, why not have more money following the choice for poor pupils? We've got measures of deprivation by postcode. It would be quite easy to implement. You could actually have a system by which, and if the waiting was big enough, schools, specialist schools, might arise that specialised in taking in children from poor areas. And not only that, because they'd be getting more money, they would be getting more resources and a much better education in consequence. So I prefer that kind of solution to the problem of cream skimming to a more sort of draconian, more command and control in many ways, of restricting admissions. But the whole point to make more generally is that cream skimming is not impossible to deal with, and there are ways of solving the problem. It is worth noting too that even if cream skimming goes on, nonetheless the effects of incentives on choice, the choice the incentives given, can sometimes outweigh the effects. The research done in the United States on school choice suggests that if you introduce choice and competition between schools, not only do the schools that are chosen get better, but so do the schools that are not chosen. It is not a zero-sum game. The schools that are not chosen improve as fast, if not faster, than the schools that are chosen. And the researcher who did this, Caroline Hawkesbury from Harvard, says it looks like what's going on is that the incentive effects of the choice and competition are working to offset even any cream skimming that might be going on within the system. So even if there is cream skimming, it is still likely that the system will work better. But as I say, I think we can deal with cream skimming on those routes. Finally, the issue of choice threatening the public realm, and the whole issue about does it undermine the public service ethos? Are hospitals and schools really different from supermarkets in a fundamental way? And again, this is there's some nice ones here. It's interesting, actually, that I've had different reactions to this cartoon. Some people have looked at it and said, they thought it was a pro-choice cartoon because it showed how convenient and how convenient things would be. But others, of course, have interpreted it less charitably. There seems to be a view here underlying all this that the public sector is run by altruists, by public-spirited altruists, and the private sector is run by robber barons. If I may use a metaphor which some of my colleagues tell me I have substantially overused already, the public sector is run by knights, and the private sector is run by knaves. There is this kind of fundamental mistrust, again, particularly from the left, of the private sector, the belief that if you let it in to the public sector in this way, it will destroy the public service ethos, it will kill off the knights and replace everybody with knaves. Well, I've written a whole book about this, as Howard indeed mentioned, and so you'll be relieved to hear, I'm not going to spend my time going through all the arguments in that now. Let me just make one or two points about it. Firstly, If the public sector is run by helpful, supportive, caring knights, then it's not really a view that's held much by the public. Now, one of these slides was out of order. But these are the words that a Morris survey did of the words that apply to public services in Britain these days. Well, you'll notice that friendly, efficient, honest, and open don't do very well. In this, and that with the exception of hard working, which does get up there, which is an interesting thing, I think, that hard working is there, but all the rest of the top lines are not exactly what adjectives that you want to label knights with. Nor does the public private sector appear to think that the public sector is the best way to run services effectively. They think a private company would do better than the government, providing a good quality service. They think the private company would do better than the government, but not as far as making services go to people who need them most. And that's very interesting. And it's a point I'll come back to in a moment or two. In the Birmingham, the Black Country, they actually asked people more directly if the NHS was going to pay people to go privately, would you be content with that? And as you can see, very dramatic, people are indeed extremely happy about having their operations in private hospitals. So that if there are, if there really are knights in the public sector, as indeed, of course, there are, and if there are knaves in the private sector, that's not really, that this view does not come out when you look at the public's attitude towards the public and private sectors. I suppose fundamentally what's going on is that and certainly my book will suggest this to you, is that the public sector does not have a monopoly on knightliness, and the private sector does not have a monopoly on knavery. In fact, individuals who work in the private sector are a mixture of knight and knave. Individuals who work in the public sector are a mixture of knight and knave. In fact, when you look at some of the evidence, particularly in the same sort of areas like nursing homes, you'll see a broadly rather similar balance between the two. I might add, the public are right when they make these kind of assumptions. There are the new independent sector treatment centres are running at several times the productivity. The exact figure is difficult to get because we don't have good figures on the NHS. We've got good figures on the productivity of the independent sector treatment centres, but not on the productivity of the NHS. But it appears as though they're running at several times the productivity of the NHS. Not entirely a fair comparison, because the NHS is doing, in the average for the NHS, it includes simple procedures and also some more complex procedures. But nonetheless, the gap between them, which can be of the order, in one case, one provision estimate, the gap in productivity is 8 times a difference. That gap can't really be explained by differences in the case mix, difference in the complexity of what's being done. Now, let me emphasize, I'm not saying, in making that comparison, that the NHS could not do this. The NHS is not intrinsically inefficient. It's just that it doesn't have the incentive to do it. It could reorganize itself in ways that match these kind of levels of productivity. And indeed, with this kind of competition and choice reforms that we're talking about, will, I think, eventually do so, will actually reorganize itself in ways that will make these achievements. To conclude, government is pouring money into the health service. It's in a different way. It's pouring money into the education system. It has to, in some sense, let these things pay off. It has to let these resources do have to actually pay off, and they have to be seen to pay off. As I've indicated, although I think there is room for performance management, although I think there's room for improvements in voice, I do not think they will be sufficient, indeed remotely sufficient, to generate the kind of improvements that we need for these services to pay off. Really, the only hope for the NHS, for the education system, is to introduce choice and competition in public services. And if we do that successfully, we will produce an efficient, a responsive, and above all, an equitable health service and education system. And that will be a legacy that any government will be proud of. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you very much, Julian. Well, we do have some time for questions, and the way that's going to work is that I'm going to exercise the choice and you're all on a kind of waiting list. Does that sort of capture the spirit of what you've been there?
Well, they should bid.
They should bid, indeed. But we'll have no postcode lottery here. We'll have them from all over the house except the man whose mobile phone went off. So who would like to... Yeah. And there's a microphone will come to you. If you could say who you are, please, before you ask.
Shirley Mergrath. How long have I got? 71% of people would be happier going into a private sector hospital. How often do we hear about disasters in private sector hospitals? They don't make headline news the way disasters in NHS hospitals do. And if you've never spoken to Emma Soames on the subject, I suggest you do that small thing. The question of patient and public participation, can I give you a brief example?
Can I just have a question, please?
A question?
Yes, this is a question and answer session.
Are you seriously suggesting that the conclusions that were come to by the Parliamentary Select Committee on Health's conclusions and recommendations, including things like ill thought through, no evidence, money figures off the wall, very unlikely to save any amount, and if it is, they're talking about 250 million out of a budget of billions. Are you questioning their conclusion that reconfiguration, which was done only 3 years ago, would take 18 months to be put into place, a new reconfiguration, and another 18 months before we got back to where we started? I understand there is evidence for this having happened in the past. Why did the government say that the PCT's arrangement, when they set them up with local authority cooperation 3 years ago, were value for money, and suddenly 3 years later they're not? Why in their
You're losing the sympathy of everybody here, including particularly me. You're going to stop, and Julian's going to answer.
Well, the point about disasters in private hospitals, it's interesting, actually. I've heard exactly the opposite comment made, that we always hear if a private company messes up, and certainly some of the comments made about the independent sector involvement in healthcare, has often, there's a focus on the problems. And if there is a problem with a private sector, this is viewed as a complete, the classic case is not so much actually with the independent sector treatment centres, but with PFI, with Private Finance Initiative. If we do hear of a problem, that is always a problem that's levied against the whole policy, and some problem with the whole PFI policy. Whereas if there's an equally bad problem in the public sector, then that's often a blip. That's just regarded as part of, that's just a blip in the system, a few bad apples. I would say that the private hospitals has no monopoly on an absence of bad publicity in these kind of areas. But I would agree with you that what we need is a proper reporting system on the problems that arise for both private and public sector. And on the Health Select Committee report, which of course looked at in detail, it is always possible to come up with a list of problems and difficulties that are associated with any particular policy. Some of those the government agreed with, some of them it did not agree with, and I'm not going to go through the list now. But more fundamentally, what you always have to reflect is that the other systems too have enormous difficulties and problems. And what I've tried to do in this talk is show that things like relying upon performance management has its problems, big problems. Things like relying upon voice has its problems. Things like relying on the old system, which had neither performance management nor voice nor choice, also had immense problems. So it's not just simply a question of listing a set of problems that might be associated with a choice or competition policy. What you have to do is to compare them with the problems that exist with other systems, problems that, in my judgment, are much more acute in most cases than the other choice and competition.
One over there, man with about as much hair as me. Thanks. Yes, you.
Can
we have a microphone? Is there another microphone on this side? No? Okay.
I was suggesting to Julian that we should concentrate these new incentives on areas where the NHS has demonstrably failed. For example, in audiology, where compared with the optician services, the state-funded service has done far less than the deregulated services. In stroke rehabilitation, and see our forthcoming reform report on mental health services, that if it can be shown that we're promoting equity in those areas where clearly there are enormous service gaps at the moment, that will create much more momentum behind the reform ideas than simply just going into the areas where we've gone so far.
Yes, I mean, I basically agree. I'm very sympathetic, as you know, Nick, to notions of direct payments. Direct payments, for those who don't know the jargon, this is basically cash payments They've been very successful in the case of social care, particularly for disabled people, giving disabled people cash so that they can purchase the care and services they need, as opposed to them having to go to a bureaucracy and to be provided by the services and so on. These have been immensely popular with the disabled people themselves. They are being spread into elderly, and some people have suggested, including me, that we could actually spread this across the red line between health and social services. And some of the areas you mentioned, mental health services, for instance, maternity services, other areas where we probably could make a much more extensive use of direct payments.
Thanks. Yes, woman back there caught my eye. Yep.
Ruth Van Dyke. I wanted to raise some questions about schools. And a couple of points is, you didn't talk about polarization and the way in which choice leads some schools getting a lot of resources and others not, and we're already in that situation. There's also segregation, that both by choice and other things, what we can have is children segregated by ethnicity, by class, and by disability. And we're not starting, you know, with schools, particularly if we think about London, on level playing fields, as well as, let's add some other social policy issues, which are league tables and national curriculum and other things that are going to influence the ability of schools to actually make decisions. So yes, you can talk about choices, but in reality, those other things have an impact on what schools can do and where they're starting from. And so all of those, you know, if you don't deal with those, then where you're going with choice doesn't work.
Thanks.
Well, I thought I had said quite a lot, actually, about the problems of polarization and segregation, although I didn't use that terminology. But essentially that's the problem of cream skimming, that the poor will end up in the sink schools and the rich will end up in the good schools. As I've said, I think there are ways of dealing with it, including the ideas of either restricting admissions or providing incentives with the system. I agree that there is a problem with that under choice systems, those schools that are failing begin to lose money. And those schools are seen to begin to get money. The interesting evidence, as I suggested, from the States is that despite that fact, the incentive structures seem to be so impressive or so powerful that they actually offset that so that the poor schools improve yet faster than the better off schools. So I think that there is, I think one. Advocates of choice do have to address the issues you mentioned, polarization and segregation, but I do think there are ways of doing it, and it'll be key, is the important to get the policy design right.
Julian, I think you deserve a question from a Blairite. David Willetts.
Well, I was going to say, Julian, I very much agreed with your analysis, but I wanted to ask you a bit about your narrative, because you did have a sort of picture in which 1997 was year zero. Do you not think that GP fund holding, grant-maintained schools, shift towards more per capita funding in education, the things that we were doing pre-97 were at least an attempt at this kind of, implementing the kind of analysis that you offered? And couldn't one argue that in 97 the problem was indeed simply that not enough money had been put behind them? When Labour got elected in 97, of course, the Blair argument was standards, not structures. Do you think that there was a Blair Mark I, which was a deliberate attempt to reverse internal markets and some of those education changes with the abolition of grant-maintained schools? And would you then define a moment, perhaps it was when you arrived at number 10, when we shifted from a Blair Mark I to a Blair Mark II, which was kind of picking up where the major government had left off? And do you think that now the choice agenda is fully implemented, or do you think more needs to be done to act on your analysis?
Right, well, several minefields there. on your first point, yes, I do think that that many of the elements that the Conservative government introduced, when you indeed were in number 10 at the time, bear parallels with what's going on now. And I think there are very useful lessons to be learned from that experience. And indeed, I've actually produced books that have discussed the lessons that might be learned from, say, the internal market and the health service. I do think that to some extent, and it'd be interesting to hear your views on this, I think the Conservative government to some extent lost its nerve, particularly in London and particularly in the health service, and again, I think it's an interesting issue, and it relates to your last question about will the current government hold its nerve when confronted with things like hospital closures and school closures. I mean, these are very difficult for all politicians of whatever political party to deal with, very difficult. One wouldn't want to minimise it. But I do think, yes, there are lessons to be learned from the kind of things that the Conservative government introduced pre-1997. And Blair Mark 1, Blair Mark 2, well, as I indicated, I think that when the government first came in, it did try the performance management route. And it still, I think, is committed, and as I said, I have some sympathy with it, to retaining elements of performance management. For instance, the target, there's an 18-week target, is still there. But I think it is probably true that the government began to think that although the targets did seem to work in the short term, whether one could continuously beat people over the head with performance management was probably not a long-term strategy, and that something else needed to be done. And I have no idea with that one things that prompted my appointment, but that was certainly one of the consequences where we have moved towards that kind of scheme.
Yeah.
Hi, Connie Jackson. I do applaud the effort at Choice, and particularly around inequalities. Two questions. I guess the issue that I'm most concerned about, though, with Choice would be around information, because that's sort of the missing piece from where patients make the choice. And what I think tends to happen, particularly for the less well-educated, is that they wind up following the GP. So is there some effort being made to look at how information can be disseminated? I mean, for example, if I need a quadruple bypass, I want someone who's done 1,000 of them, not someone who's done 5. And is there information around how well they've done? And then I guess the other thing would be in terms of looking at the minority health inequality agenda, people who have done better with treating minority groups, if there's a way to look at information around that.
Yes, is the answer. There is a lot of work going on trying to improve information. You're absolutely right, of course. I mean, it's absolutely critical to get that right. There is information, particularly on the mortality rates of individual cardiac surgeons, actually, that is now coming into the public domain. Which I must say is quite brave. It's brave of cardiac surgeons, many of them. I'm not too keen on it, but nonetheless. But you're absolutely right. I mean, it is a critical part of if this is to work, that we do have to have good information. But I think that'll be a benefit in and of itself. I mean, I think it'll be a good thing. It'll be empowering and very useful, and very enormously useful for researchers, of course, like myself, to work out what's going on. So, yes, very important. And yes, the government is trying to do something about it. Is trying to provide the appropriate information, and really it can only get better.
Information by professor on successful PhD completion rates.
Yes. No, it's a bad idea.
Yeah, I thought you might say so. George Jones.
George Jones, ex-LSE. You said that the middle class like non-choice systems, which they can manipulate. If so, why then does a government which needs the middle class vote and wants to appeal to middle England champion choice systems? That's a question also for David Willetts.
Which he's not going to be allowed to answer.
Oh, isn't he? Oh, I was just going to offer it to him to answer.
We have to preserve balance here.
We have a government, George, that is dedicated to doing the right thing. And it is committed to introducing choice, not for electoral reasons, but because it is actually the only way successfully to reform public services.
Yeah.
Professor Brown, can you hear me?
My name is Barry Feinberg. I'm speaking from quite a different perspective, being in LSE, from that of an architect and a planner and a general design view. The government is certainly to be congratulated on the increased resources it's put in such a short time in both the fields of education and health. But I wonder whether there's been a basic incorrect assumption about the structures, which, if we think about it, might explain some of the failures and disappointments. One of the driving assumptions in the post-war years has been economies of scale, economies in the large-scale school, the large-scale hospital. And that has meant not only that we built, relatively speaking, widely dispersed schools and hospitals, but not only are they widely dispersed, they often have to find sites which are more remote from where people live in order that they're available at market costs, at market affordable levels of cost, which increase travel distances as well also for pupils and for ambulances and so on. If instead there had been a recognition that the initial scale of operation, which was about one-tenth of the new scale, had continued, then the choice now would be tenfold what it is, much closer to home as well, which happily is the theme of the very latest white papers from the Department of Health and from the government, which even this morning is asserting the need for smaller scale local structures. I'll leave it at that. I hope that I've made the point that we may have got the whole picture wrong because the diseconomy of the large size was never questioned, was never challenged, and the much greater economy of the smaller unit, one that's tenth the size, would probably be 10 times more efficient.
Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure. I agree with some parts of that, but not in its entirety. I do think that we have probably built hospitals that are much too big. But I'm not sure it's entirely because we were after economies of scale as such. It's more because the hospitals were trying to do everything. They were universal hospitals, like universities. Every hospital seemed to believe it had to have a specialty in certain areas, in every area. Now, actually, the evidence then suggests that economies of scale do matter within specialties. That the more procedures that a surgeon does, obvious in a sense, I mean, the more procedures a surgeon does, the more likely they are to be successful. And I think that the trend is probably towards smaller specialist hospitals and away from large-scale hospitals. And I think large-scale universal hospitals. And I think, actually, that's, again, something you have to think about when thinking about the reform agenda. Is the best way to manage that transition via choice and competition? Or is the best way through, I don't know, some form of performance management or whatever, or some kind of centrally planned system? I'm deeply skeptical of the notion that planning will get it right. And I think that choice and competition, again, if designed right, will probably enable us to fulfill that trend successfully, to meet that trend successfully. But I think there is a real issue there that has to be addressed.
I'm going to take one from the discounted seats up the top here. Somebody who caught my eye up there, yeah? Who was it? Yeah. Was it you? Yeah. You'll have to shout.
Sorry, to differentiate between schools and hospitals.
Could you shout very loudly?
Schools are much more than hospitals. They're social institutions where most people are going to spend between 11 and 13 years of their lives. They shape the type of country and type of community we live in. On the issue of segregation, I take your point about segregation between rich and poor. Imagine a society where you've got complete equality of wealth, yet you've got other sources of what have been referred to as horizontal inequalities, where you could end up with choice with a very polarized set of communities that don't really interact. I want to ask you, is there a trade-off here with the choice agenda between the type of society we might try and build and the type of society that a choice agenda in schools might build for us?
Well, I mean, I think there's a lot of... there's a kind of romantic notion when people talk about local schools and local communities. It's some idea that there was once a world in which the squire's daughter went to the local school with the cobbler's son. Now, in fact, that probably never existed, and it certainly doesn't exist now. The squire's daughter goes to Rodine, almost certainly. The notion of the kind of local community running alongside, local community school running alongside an elitist private school system, it seems to be a nonsense. The segregation that we have at the moment in schools, with very little choice, with many schools making their choices based on catchment areas, we have a highly segregated system. I think it's our own. In fact, there is some evidence to suggest, it's controversial evidence, that since the Conservatives introduced an element of school choice in 1989, segregation has actually decreased as compared with the 1988 situation. Now, it is controversial evidence, but it's certainly, we cannot assume that if we did not have choice and competition, that we would have some wonderful world where there was, everybody went to their local school and there was a perfect sense of community. We would not have that. We would have something more like our present system, which frankly I think is more segregated and more divisive than a choice and competitive system would be.
Now, I've got a question there. I've got one person who's been very patient here, and then we maybe run out of time. Yeah, go for it.
Two questions. First question is, any successful policy or strategy, proof of the pudding is in implementing the strategy. What do you see as the key risks to implementing a choice policy, particularly with respect to the NHS? That's number one. Number two, as regards the NHS, where do you see from a system-wide perspective, where do you see the boundaries of competition and cooperation interfacing, and how should they be managed?
The biggest risk. I think the biggest risk, and I thank you for asking that question because I think it is a terribly important one, is failure to deal with failure. One of the problems that beset the Conservatives' experiment with the internal market was the problem of failing hospitals, and particularly in London was one of the key issues. And it is, and I know this because I've been on the other end of it myself. I mean, when I was in Number 10, there was a problem of hospital closing, and it was incredibly difficult to deal with. Politicians are under enormous pressure when there are hospitals closing. Of course, there's the classic Kidderminster case. The biggest failure, the biggest risk of the implementation of choice is if we implement choice, we implement competition, and then we start engaging in some unconsidered bailing out of failing services. How can we deal with this? I think that there are ways of doing it. It's quite interesting what happened with Bradford. Bradford was a foundation trust that got into trouble. The way it was dealt with was that there was a regulator called Monitor who regulates foundation trusts, and they were given the responsibility for doing something about it. And indeed they did. They sacked the chair, and I think the chief exec in the end. There was a whole range of things they brought in. But the interesting thing about it was that Bradford was turned round, but neither the Secretary of State for Health nor the Prime Minister, much to my relief, had to stand up in the House of Commons and defend what was going on. The regulator actually successfully insulated the political system from the trials and tribulations of this particular hospital, and I think that there's a very useful lesson there. I think with a regulator, with an appropriate regulator, you can engage in that kind of insulation, and it is terribly important that that happens, because if we get back to a system which there is just endless bailout of failing institutions, which we've done all our lives, and has always been true of public services. This has nothing really to do with choice and competition. We have always bailed out the failures. Then the system is not going to work. Competition and cooperation, well, it's a much bigger issue, and I don't think, where the limits are, it will vary. On the whole, I tend to think probably we've had in the NHS historically a little too much cooperation and not enough competition.
Yes, I was aware when I was a regulator that I was sometimes there in order to protect ministers from the consequences of their policy choices. But, last one, I think.
Nick Wilson. Julian, thank you for your presentation. I would say, though, that having heard several of the questions and the tenor of them, it sometimes surprises me the way that sometimes very intelligent people seem to disregard some statistics and information that they're given. And it seems to me that that is the toughest test that you're going to face in the next, say, 5 years to implement this. So given that the fact that the Prime Minister is talking about moving on in a couple of years, we've got a fairly centrally minded Chancellor who presumably will take over. Given the fact we've got civil servants, we've got all these pressure groups that are trying to fight their corner, how, in fact, are you going to ensure that this gets implemented?
Well, I'm obviously in no position to ensure anything anymore, if indeed I ever was. I do believe that evidence will steadily accumulate to the effect that these reforms are in place and are working. We're already seeing it with the independent sector treatment centres, as I said. We're seeing evidence of improvement. That seems to me to imply that whoever the next Prime Minister is, he or she will look at the reforms that are going on, will look at the public services. And if the reforms are seen to be working, I think it would be very curious and very surprising for any politician to reverse them. So the key will be whether the reforms do work, and to pick up your point about data at the beginning, and whether they are seen to work. And I do think a key aim of people like me, a key and researchers more generally, is to, in a sense, keep the government's nose to it, is to make sure that we do produce the evidence and undertake the tests to make sure that the reforms are working, which is probably a good note on which you need to stop, because that will mean more money coming to the universities, which seems an excellent thing.
Yes. Well, when you said, Julian, you're not responsible for anything, you are, of course, still responsible for teaching our students social policy and for teaching the analytical techniques that will need to be brought to bear on the consequences of the policies that you have so elegantly outlined. Thank you very much for spending the time and trouble. I'm not sure it was entirely worth losing you for a year, but it was some kind of recompense to the school. Thank you.
Thank you.